Hi, how are you? Just real quick, before we get to our conversation with Bobcat Goldthwait, Jess and I would like to remind everybody that this Saturday night, June 6th, in Dayton, Ohio, at Wiley's Comedy Club, at 5 p.m., we're going to have a live recording of the Off the Air podcast. Jess and I will be there. We'll have Off the Air t-shirts, and our guest will be Bob Zaney, world-famous comedian, Bob Zaney. That's right. And if you'd like to get tickets, they are available online, wileyscomedy.com, no apostrophe. That's WileysComedy.com, wileyscomedy.com. Order your tickets, and we will see you Saturday night, this Saturday night, June 6th, at Wiley's Comedy Club in Dayton, Ohio. It's going to be a hoot. It's going to be pretty cool. Come out and say hi. Okay, now, our conversation with the one, the only, Bobcat Goldthwait.
Without bubbles in this room. Without Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Is his medication dialed in or something? Because he seemed...
he seemed good? Did he seem really good. Good.
Sometimes when he's...
It's a day-by-day thing.
When he's engaged.
He's
the best when he's engaged.
Was the best he's been in recent memory for me.
But when he's not engaged and when he's... I'm not telling you.
I really was like thinking, I was like, is he on meds? Because he's really...
He should be. He absolutely should be.
Maybe he is. He's in a relationship where he loves her. So I think that has a lot to do with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll screw you up. That'll fuck you up.
That
love thing. It's not for the...
It's not for the weak?
It's not for the weak. Mm-hmm. I see why everything's written about it. And
yeah, but you know, all good love songs are not based on being happy. They're really dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
They're terrible. They're, you know, and that's a good love song.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
He hit me and it felt like a kiss. I'm not saying that's a good example, but it's dark, I'll tell you that.
I know. That's the way these things work, though. I mean, how did the shows go last?
No one got hurt.
No one got hurt?
No one got hurt. Actually, they were really good. They were really fun.
I knew they would be. But, that's a kind of a redesigned club and stuff.
Yeah, they painted it. It was day and night. No, it was. It's you know, I have a hard time when I'm doing shows and the whole audience is there for the wrong reason. You know, when they're there for some nostalgic reason and and that wasn't the case, or they're just too old now to act inappropriately.
Really,
you know, when a crowd's going woo. how do you cheer them up?
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
yeah.
We love you. Wah! And you're like, hi, good evening. There's no place to start.
There's no place to go then, right? He's finally here.
I know. Are you excited?
I'm very excited. I know. So I'm.
Let's talk about him like he's not here.
Yes, he is. He is here.
She used to, her favorite thing is trying to scare people.
Yeah.
She likes jumping out and scaring people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, mostly children.
Oh, sure.
Good. So naturally, I would
How about animals?
Yeah, them too. Yeah.
You don't scare a monkey because they've got crazy strength.
But I have a point because she would get upset at me because she would try to scare me. And my fear would be, I don't really react.
He doesn't have a physical reaction to
you
being scared.
You don't have a central nervous system?
So
you would have to act? You would have to go...
No, and in order partially to make her feel better, I was scared, but I would have to announce, you just scared the hell out of me.
Right.
Oh, you didn't go, huh?
So I...
Yeah.
That's why I...
Or you would try to fake being scared like 2 seconds after I scared him. Yeah.
So
I appreciate
it. So there'd be a lag time?
Yeah.
It'd be like watching a dubbed movie?
So when I'm really nervous, I just don't do anything.
Well, that is I was thinking of this and last night I actually told this story. I was seeing a woman, a charming lady, and she she wanted to be dominated, that she enjoys that. And I'm not a prude, you know, and I think, and in my head, I'm like going, wow, yeah, you know. But
You're a pleaser.
But or, you know, I think everybody has, you know, think, you know, this isn't that weird.
No.
And so she brought a whip to my apartment. And so here's the thing. If someone wants to be dominated, now there's two things that come up. They're actually in control. And the other thing is I have lines. Now I have a part to play.
Right.
And I hate acting. I really do. So it's, she said, she goes, this is right from my life. She goes, I've been a bad girl.
She actually said that.
Yeah. And I go, well, we're all flawed. I really do. I was like, you know, that's the, some say we're born with the original sin. You know, I don't believe that, but sure. You know, we all have character defects. And, but yeah, like I totally intentionally sabotaged the mood because it was
too practical.
Well, no, it was.
Or were you trying to help?
It ended up being so unspontaneous, you know, because now I'm supposed to say, yes, you have, or I don't know what my line is, you know.
I was going to say, did she tell you what to say? Because John Evans was in here, and he told us that she very specifically said, you are to be a Southern slave owner.
No, no, something I do know like that.
Yeah, very, it was a
Southern hair salon owner.
Hair salon, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it about the South? What is
it's in, and yeah, and she didn't have enough money to pay for her haircut.
Yes.
Wait a minute, you know the John Evans story?
Yeah, yeah, John's a good friend of mine. And so it's like, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, line.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm off book here. So, yeah, it's horrible. Oh, and then I got a text saying, hey, I can't find my whip. Did I leave it at your apartment? So I was like, well, I thought it was a gift, but I couldn't find it.
You couldn't find it, but she knew she left it at your...
And my housekeeper put it with the cat toys.
It seems like that makes sense.
Yeah, because it is fantasy,
yeah,
right? Because
okay.
The cat toy is not really a mouse.
No.
Well, let's start the show, shall we? Okay. Hey, look at me running the controls.
Good job. First time.
Maybe I shouldn't draw attention to it. That kind of... Hi, welcome back to the Off the Air podcast. I'm Chick, that's Jess. Let's get out of here while the siren starts. And it's one of our dream guests here for the first time.
That's a lot of pressure. I better be fascinating. I better blow people's asses right through their faces. Like,
you've already been wonderful, and we haven't even really started the show.
Oh, okay, good. But I had no
idea the DEA. It's Bobcat Goldthwait. He does everything. He directs. He doesn't like to, he acts
every
now and then.
Yeah, I don't act.
He doesn't act.
Clearly, with that story.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you, but you're a director, so didn't you want to just dive right in? And
No. Because I would have had to be in control. And if someone wants to be dominated, they are actually in control.
The one being?
Yeah.
The one being dominated is
yeah, they're definitely calling the shots because
they have the safe word. Right?
They have the safe word, and
they have that's true,
scenarios.
And they set the whole thing up.
Yeah,
and
they came
asked.
In here saying you will dominate,
and there's parameters, you know. So
nothing in the face, stuff like that.
Yeah, this is parameters. So now it's too much thinking. It's it's the opposite of spontaneous.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the fun part about it, is you go in there and you're not real sure what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I've learned also, I talk a good game is what it boils down to. I talk a very good game.
Did you find you were thinking too much that you couldn't really?
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, right?
It took me right. It ended it for me. And then we just went really traditional.
Straight ahead.
See, right. In sexting, I have quite the imagination. But when in the harsh reality, it's very traditional and rather boring.
Did this start out as sexting?
A little bit of that.
Oh, okay.
You know, a little bit of that. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
What are you saying? Is that where she got the idea that he might be?
Right, that he would be down. Yeah.
No, that was her idea.
Oh.
I yeah. But, you know, again, I'm not prudish, I don't think. All this stuff is very new to me because I've always been in relationships almost my entire adult life, you know. And so now here at 53, I'm dating and stuff. So it's weird. It's very weird. I can tell a story, but I'm really going to have to change, not change, just leave out some facts.
That we love those stories.
And this is back east, when my daughter was in college, she needed a car, and I knew a guy who was a car dealer, and he sold us a car, and he was a very nice guy, and the car was a complete lemon. It was terrible. It broke down, the engine broke, everything, it was terrible. And then, lo and behold, this guy's at a show of mine, and I talk about this lemon that he sold. And then he steps up and is amazing and just sends her a check in full the next day.
Wow.
So I'm an asshole in this story, right? So clearly.
So it was worth him that money. It's worth it to him. Okay.
So then I was sexting with some woman who her name is very similar to this gentleman's name.
Okay.
And so I sent him a filthy text in the middle of the night.
Oh.
So he immediately says, "Hey, Bobcat, I don't think this is who you're meant to send this to." And I wrote, "Merry Christmas," because it was Christmas. So now let's jump cut. And here's the part I'll have to leave out. But there was I was at a function, and it was a famous, well-known person was having this party. And this is now in California. So, I never thought I'd see that guy again, And then, lo and behold, he's there at the party. And the guy having the party goes, "Hey, do you know?" And I go, "Oh, yeah, we know." And he goes, "Yeah, Bobcat wants to eat my pussy." So I'm learning. These are all things that I cringe at the idea of my daughter hearing any of this, my adult daughter.
Right.
But I also know talking about the most embarrassing stuff is comedy gold.
Yeah. And it's part of let the healing begin. That's right.
I don't know what's going on with me. I don't know what phase this is, but I'm sure it'll be over soon.
Until you find another relationship, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. You said
how
you
long
were
the
seeing...
longest you've been single?
I think this is it, right?
I really have. I've always been either married or in a new relationship. So yeah, it's been it's new to me. Yeah, I've never dated, and I never, that's all that stuff that people do when they're young, in their 20s and stuff. I got on Letterman when I was 20. I had my daughter when I was 23, so, and then I was married to her mom for 10 years. And then, and then I was in another relationship after that. So, yeah, I've just gone from relationship to relationship. And then I was married, and then that ended last year. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
She's getting the big eyes at me because this is very similar to
you,
my life, and I've always been from relationship to relationship to relationship, and it does have some it does have at times the appearance of an addiction, and I think that was certainly my case for quite a while.
Well, but the I guess it's the for me, the low self-esteem and this crazy fear of being alone,
mm-hmm.
And I guess some people are comfortable being alone, but I don't think I am. I know I'm not. Even when I was a little tiny boy, I was thinking about getting married.
Really?
Yeah, that's really weird.
I think it's sweet. Were your parents married? Did they?
Yeah, my parents liked each other up until I was about 16, and then they did not like each other.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was really. And then they got a divorce on their 40th anniversary.
Wow.
Because the Pope said you could get a divorce, and then they went and got a divorce.
Gotcha.
But and then because of the nature of relationships, they immediately moved into the same apartment building, and my father would be like, "Saw your mother today getting mail." I'd be like, "Yeah, that's so her. That's so her.
Oh boy, what is she thinking?
What is she? Oh, that's her
going out there getting mail.
Just tomcatting around." some people just need to be driven nuts.
How did you negotiate that? Did you, because they want you to take sides.
Yeah.
But
even when you're that old?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think more so.
Yeah, you were an adult. My parents divorced when I was very young, so it was just
my mother and father, my mother in true white trash fashion, they broke up when I was, I'm going to say 14 or 15, but continued to live in the same house. And then when I moved away when I was 18, my dad moved out, and my mom said, "Well, I'm not going to let you do that." And then my mom moved out. But they stayed married right up until my father died, which was, I don't know, 15 years, not that long. And then they were married. And
they never split up? They never found divorced anyone else?
No. They both lived with other people.
With other people, but they both kind of left that out of their memories. They didn't. But because when my father died, my mother went bananas. I mean, you would have thought that they'd been married, and
really?
She threw herself
on the casket.
Tried to do that.
Take me.
Yeah. And
really,
he left me like I don't know, $3,000 or something.
Wow.
And she said these words as we're driving to the graveyard for the service. "Where's mine?"
Mm-hmm. well,
yeah.
I remember having to fill out some paperwork when my father passed away, and it said, you know, like the estate of Thomas Goldthwait or something. It's he actually didn't leave me a pot to piss in. That was part of, but I didn't care.
Right.
That was the thing. It was like we're all divvying up nothing, you know.
Right.
And I think it ended up being like $500 or $700. I used it to frame an Ed Wood poster I have at home.
He would have liked that, probably.
Well, I don't know if he'd like a transvestite, but he might have. I don't know. He was probably more open-minded.
Was it Glenn or Glenda, right?
It is, it is a Glenn or Glenda three sheet, you know, so it's giant.
It
fills the whole wall up, and it's... And so I thought I'd use that money because it's something that I would look at every day.
Yeah.
You know, what else am I going to, you know, do with that money?
I used mine to, I bought an Atari 2600.
Something you'll look at every day.
I looked at it every day.
Every day.
I thought that would be around for the rest of my life.
He would appreciate it.
He would appreciate that. And
that's true.
That's a true story.
But it's weird when, you know, my eldest brother, when he passed away, he was... a character, he so many stories about my older brother. When I was a boy growing up, he was just charming and bigger than life and loved had a history of drugs and other things later on in life. But it was funny, even then, when he couldn't have been more antisocial, people were still gravitated to him, you know. Mm-hmm. And
how much older was he?
7 years. And at his funeral, one of his pallbearers was a little person, and little Ricky. Everybody, no one had a regular name. It was always because he was a biker. You know, it's like you know, what I mean?
Fist and
it was always
Spike.
Beaver, and you know, I don't know a lot of these guys. We got to invite him to the funeral. What's Low Life's real name?
So we got to find him, right?
Yeah, I know Big Mitch, but you know, so sure enough, you know, little Ricky was one of the pallbearers, and my daughter and I are in the church, and we look, and this is the first time we get wind of this, actually. And I say to my daughter, I go, "It looks like Ricky's riding a subway." And my daughter goes, "I think he just got air." So my daughter and I are losing it. You know, we're laughing. So we're burying our face and people see our shoulders shaking and they're all rubbing us.
Right.
So it'll be okay.
Aww.
But, you know, my brother used to hunt. He was a poacher, actually. He didn't really and the game warden would come into his house and with locks, and they'd bust open and find illegal game, and did a lot of things. He was a fascinating guy.
Fascinating.
And so
charming.
Yeah, like my friend Tony V and I once we went to visit my brother and we pull up, and he's living out in central New York, but in the woods, and there's we pull up and there's corn, but it's not in rows in his yard. It's just, it's like psycho corn. It's just shooting up. It's not, it's, there's no, it wasn't tilled. It was just seeds were planted. And Tony's like, hey, what's going on with all the corn? Like, Tony thought it grew wild. He goes, what's up with the corn? And my brother goes, oh, I plant it. It's for the deer. And he's like, oh, you help them through the winter? He's like, I'm going to blast them. So my brother, I go up to the bathroom on the second floor and the window's broken. I go, what happened to the window here? And he goes, oh, you know, Bobby, it was recoil, Bobby. You know? So my brother was sitting on the bowl shooting deer. He's like, want to go hunting? Meet me in the kitchen.
On the pot.
Oh, and then Tony and I were leaving. Tony had never met my brother, and this is the first time we met him. He just goes, your brother's certifiable. You know, there's guns, and it's just crazy. And as we're leaving, Tony, because he's from the city, he's from Boston, he goes, what is that over there? It was a woodchuck. And, yeah. And so we're not even down the end of the driveway, and we hear blammo. And Tony's like, I fingered that woodchuck. I go, yes, you did. You dropped a dime on that woodchuck. That woodchuck died because you pointed it out to,
oh my God,
to a man who had to go shoot it immediately. Oh.
How many siblings do you have?
There was, including myself, five.
There's five kids. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that was that.
Yeah,
big
I'm the end of a Catholic family. Yeah.
Oh, that's I remember right now that you were raised Catholic.
Yeah. So there was five kids. I was the baby, and I have an older brother, Jimmy, who lives out in Los Angeles, and he's an assistant director on He works on a lot of features, and well, now he does a lot of TV series. But sometimes we work together, and for the most part, it goes really well. I mean, I'm, you know, the two different sides of the brain. You know, I think I'm on the creative side, and he's more organized. So it'll be like, you know, we really got to get going because the sun's going down. And I'm like, how come Mom and Dad gave you that car in high school? What is that about?
Well, you know? Bob, we can talk about that later.
Yeah, it's not the time, you know. But he's a little more, you know, he's a little more, and his role in the family was like, if everybody would just calm down, we could bring out the birthday cake. So it fits right in with his job now.
What did your parents do?
My mom was a Sears employee, and my father was a sheet metal worker.
Oh, okay.
He was a tin knocker.
So yeah. Who was the funniest, or where did all this come from?
They both were two different things. My mother was very sarcastic and very dry and very dark, you know. Like, you know, she would always say just the oddest things. Like, you know, you'd be in church and she'd go, that family's home in a bag of assholes, you know. And I'm like, what?
Well, you're right, Mom. They aren't attractive, certainly. But I'm sure
home in a bag of assholes during church. I'm like, so that's clearly one part of me. But my dad was the other side of things. He was very sometimes it was almost Andy Kaufman-esque, but it was most of his stuff was his stunts were always fueled by beer, you know. So he would do these things like he would, you know, invite all the neighbors over, and he'd be tight, he'd be in the bag, but he would tell everybody that he was going to jump off the refrigerator into a jar of mayonnaise, and it usually would involve a cape and things, and he would open a jar of mayonnaise and put it on the and climb up on top of the refrigerator, and he would, you know, make these great speeches, and he'd really whip the crowd up. And then there was always something at the last moment. It's like, oh, is that Hellman's? Oh, no. You know, so
I can't dive into a Hellman's. They're,
yeah. So there's always.
They're non-union.
Yeah. There'd always be something in his thing. Like once we had an above-ground pool in the backyard, and he spent the day building a ramp to jump it, and he had my brother's dirt bike, and he just kept going.
Was this around the Evel Knievel time?
Yeah. So, and he kept going up and down. Remember how Evel Knievel would go up and down the ramp?
Take a look.
Back,
and get the crowd nuts? Yep. Yeah. So my dad just kept doing that because he was letting the motorcycle run out of gas. So he did that a million times. A million times, and everybody was out of their minds, like really thinking he was going to jump, and then he's, oh. Yeah. So there was always some sort of
Then there'd be a party, probably.
There was always a party. Yeah. We were that house, you know, that house like in the movie Mask, you know, where there was always Harleys on the front yard and kegs of beer.
Syracuse,
New York, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, and then Tom Kenny's family was the direct opposite. You know, we were working class, keg parties.
They were the Kennys? Were they the Kennys?
They weren't that bougie, but they were college educated, and Tom's father was a CPA at the big air conditioner factory, and he was just, it was completely different, yeah.
Right.
It was completely different.
But your senses of humor, yours and Tom's, were... Because you started out as a team, right, or something?
Well, no, we met when we were 6 years old. Tom Kenny, for folks listening, is the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants, and yeah. He was on Mr. Show, and he's
tall, thin guy,
really funny,
Kramer-esque hair.
He's been in a million animated shows, like he's on Adventure Time, and you know he's really the king of cartoons right now. But he, we met when we were 6 years old. I had annoyed my nun so much, who was my first grade teacher, that she dragged me into his classroom sobbing, and he remembers this, and then I was sobbing too, and she just said, "I can't take him anymore," and she just left me there for the other teacher.
Oh.
And he thought it was really cool that I could make a grown nun cry, so he introduced himself at lunch, so that's how we became friends.
You did this at six? The nun said, I can't
take him anymore, yeah. And I had no idea what would have been.
Are nuns supposed to do that? I mean, I'm not organized religion ever, but...
But I think it was just, I really broke this poor woman's spirit, you know. I had mentioned that that Christmas Day is not the actual day of Christ's birth or something like that. Like, and yeah. So,
at six?
Yeah, I was annoying. You know, it's funny that I've become... You know, I don't know. It was really, like, I walked home from intramural baseball, so it was, you know, pre-Little League when I was 6 years old, and I told the coach that I didn't want to participate in organized sports.
At six?
At six. I was, it's weird, because now, I mean, I'm more like, you know, Bluto. than I am. I don't know why. Yeah.
So you think you were much more thoughtful and introspective and self-aware at six than you are now?
I think so. I definitely did. I think I had more. I was certainly way more inquisitive, I think, as a little boy. You know, nothing ever. You know, I was so disappointed by the facts of these things that we would learn that were supposed to be truths. And as a little boy, they would shatter me, you know, these things that you would find out. And
what about the Santa Claus thing?
That's what I'm saying. Like Santa Claus, you know, that was devastating. It's still to this day, it hurts my feelings, you know, because everybody else was lying. You know,
they're all in on it. Everybody's in on it.
I mean, like,
that's why I've hated the idea of Santa Claus from when I had children. And mine was more, it was less for them than it was for me, because I thought, why does this guy get all the credit?
Yeah, and I'm doing all the work.
Yeah. And so I've never been a...
Did you say there was a Santa?
I let their grandparents tell them that Santa Claus comes to their house.
Wow.
I don't know.
I've never, about it.
Yeah, I just didn't want to ever... I was never a fan.
And well, that's good.
They're 11 and 9, though,
I didn't
right?
deny them that experience, because I thought I had that experience and I'm okay, you know, right. When I found out, but I just didn't want to be the one. When they get... When they're 53, I want them to go, "My mom didn't tell us there was a..."
That's
Santa
cool.
Claus. And so I'm okay with that.
But my ex-wife, her parents, and I think this is child abuse, they would say that there is everybody else believes in this archetypal gift giver that is in all these different cultures, and we don't believe in this archetypal gift giver.
Wow.
And then would put a string of lights on a cactus. She grew up in New Mexico, and then each kid would get like a book and a piece of clothing or something like that.
Wow.
It was just, it was horrible.
Oh my gosh. See, I don't,
it's almost worse than Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, they don't.
Yeah, but I know Jehovah's, that they do their loopholes.
They do present present day, gift day.
Yeah, they'll have like party. True. Not it's not a party. Even,
no,
but
it's
because I used to know this family that we would have to not call it Christmas,
right.
But we better have a gift.
Sure. A friend of mine told me that, well, think about it. I want, this is the same kid who told me that you could get a girl pregnant by urinating inside them.
Right.
That guy.
Right.
Doug Parsons.
Doug Parsons.
Son of a bitch. No, he goes, well, think about it. If Santa Claus was, he'd get arrested for breaking and entering. He can't go into houses. And when you're, I think I got it 9, 10 along in there. Mm-hmm. I'm like, really? I was down the river with the
old.
I had no idea how those cookies were gone. The milk was gone.
Sure.
And plus, my mom and dad weren't, I knew even, 7, 8, 9, they're not that caring or giving, or so there must have been something.
There was somebody involved.
Some other power involved, you know?
Well, but what was this gentleman's name? Tom?
Doug. Doug Parsons.
Doug Parsons. So Doug had,
Doug taught me the word fuck. He was,
He thought that they were breaking and entering.
Santa, if there was a Santa Claus, he wasn't saying there wasn't, but if there wasn't, he would get.
Was he at the reunion?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I think he might have passed away.
So he clearly, we've learned a lot about his home life. Breaking and entering was in a 10-year-old's vocabulary.
He had a big party when we were juniors. He lived like eight or nine houses away on the same street, and they had a big party, and a kid died at that party. And
wow.
Doug was legend, and it was
He was a legend?
A classmate of mine. No, I mean, well, a bad legend, but I mean, it was like, yes.
Wow, was this from alcohol poisoning?
Yeah, fell asleep on their back, and we were like, 16, 17.
Wow, were you at this party?
No, I was supposed to go, but
you're that guy. The guy that I was supposed to be there, but
you could have woken him up.
I could have woken him up. I would have nudged him or turned him over, flipped him over.
Was he a drummer?
He fell asleep. He fell asleep in the bushes and
oh my god,
aspirated and the whole deal. Yeah,
no way.
That would be a legendary party, though.
See, I'm right.
It is a legendary party. So, oh my goodness,
I didn't really drink a lot.
You didn't drink at all.
No, I want to say eighth grade, freshman year, I would steal liqueur from Kroger's and go home and watch Don Kirshner's rock concert, like a raspberry liqueur, all by myself. When I enjoyed being alone, Bobcat,
That's really sad.
When I enjoyed, shut up.
Drinking then, alone as a kid, watching ABBA.
But then,
he loved ABBA. He still does.
Well, ABBA is a valid
Dancing
song.
Queen is a damn fine song.
They're valid songwriters.
Muriel's Wedding, great movie, I'm telling you.
Mm.
With Rachel.
That was a bad, I should have went with the Sanford Townsend band.
There you go, smoke from a distance. Anyway. So I didn't really, and then I kind of stopped drinking until, I want to say 23, 24, 25, because I would buy beer for everybody else because I was 18 the November of my senior year.
So you were
year.
Clean from the time you were 14 until...
So you were the enabler?
So I would make money selling kids beer.
Oh, okay.
And oh, then, I did because, that with cigarettes.
Because I was...
I did. I was the first one to turn 18 when we were in school, and so I would always charge people $2 more whenever I'd have to go inside to buy cigarettes.
That's not bad.
Nice.
Yeah.
But I was a wreck house from like 13 to 19. I was a mess. I went to jail 3 times for drinking. Not. I didn't stay.
I was going because I know the story that you've been sober since you were 19.
Yeah, I've been sober since I was 19.
So I wanted to ask what the hell happened before you got to 19. But yeah,
I was just I never drank socially or I never drank with any amount of decorum. It was always I could have easily been that kid in the bushes.
Right.
I just drank
right.
myself to oblivion at a really young age. I've never done anything in moderation, so why would I be able to do that?
You're here.
So I got sober when I was a kid, and I usually don't talk about it, but at this point, after 34 years, I'm kind of like, I'm just so tired of people you can't change people's perception of you, but I get bored with people, just the other day on Instagram, someone tagged, isn't it? Look how high you are in this photo, and it's like, no, I'm not high at all.
The picture, you and Bill Hicks, right, at Wiley's, and I thought you... I know what face you were making. That's the face you made on stage. And yeah, I didn't.
And guy goes, no disrespect, but look how high you were.
Instagram comments.
But you know what I think it is?
Pissed me off.
But I think, I think a lot of this comes from.
I was just going to say, so 13 to 19, you were, so that must have been at a time you were first on stage?
Yeah, I mean, I started doing stand-up around then, too. You know, I mean, the first time, like, in a nightclub, I was 16, but even before then, I was doing stand-up, Tom Kenny and I,
right.
At, like, you know, wherever we could get on stage. But on my first HBO special in the early 80s, this is so dated, it was back when, you know, Nancy Reagan was saying, just say no. And I said, you know, I've never been sitting there with like a pile of blow and a shotgun and I'm going to use one of these. And then, you know, Nancy Reagan says, just say no. And I go, oh, thanks. Yeah. and I think as I talked about, I didn't do that much drugs, but because on HBO I openly talked about doing coke. I guess that's a weird thing. I mean, I guess
now it's certainly not.
But is it though? I mean, I think even now. I mean,
you don't hear people saying it's much more acceptable to say you get high than to say you do coke.
But if you said you did drugs, you know, like there's people who joke about it, and there's a few people who talk about it, you know, and I'm not saying they're even abusive in their nature, but like, you know, Joe Rogan will openly talk about taking hallucinogens or, mm-hmm. or whatever, and like Doug Stanhope, he'll talk about right. drugs and stuff. But for the most part, people don't talk about it. And just because I talked about it, I think that's shocking, and maybe that's what that fouled me.
I don't know if you're you must be aware of this, but I remember like two or three comedians the first time I saw them, where I was, I could vividly see, oh my God, who's this guy? Sam Kinison, Rodney Dangerfield on The Tonight Show, and you.
Wow.
And I was convinced that you were... Because you stayed in character
sure, yeah.
for the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh my God, this guy.
So did you think I was on drugs?
And I thought, I didn't know what to think, but I'm getting chills talking about it because your performance that really stands out was you were doing this entire thing as Bobcat or whatever you called that character. And then you did this Bono impersonation.
Right.
That was dead the fuck on. And I thought, not only is this guy not that guy, but he's fucking intelligent and funny and wonderful, and he can do this imitation. I was blown away.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. So maybe that's where people got the idea that you were that way all the time.
Yeah. I mean, the comics that influenced me that I liked was like Andy Kaufman. So that was totally, you know, that was just a page out of Andy Kaufman. You know, I'd come out and do this persona. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd come out and do his persona, and then, right. and then he'd do Elvis. So, you know, I mean, I guess
right.
that's the closest
well,
thing to
too,
it. So
right,
I did the
yeah.
persona,
and his
then
Elvis,
I did Bono.
His Elvis was incredible. Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
It was funny because, yeah, I did get a call from Bono, and it was very nice. He was very nice. And then I went to, I think I've told this story on Bob and Tom, but with mm-hmm.
The sunglasses.
Yeah. 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 Thanks, Mean Joe. So I won't tell it here. But yeah. So.
No. But what did you? What did you call? You didn't call it. Call him. That wonderful ad lib joke fell on.
Oh, it oh, yes, fell yes, deaf yes. on his Gaelic ears. Yeah. It was.
Didn't he know who this? He no. didn't know who Mean Joe was. Didn't know who the no. Steelers were. Didn't know who the National Football League was. Didn't
yeah.
know, the
well,
whole,
I've
the whole
always,
fucking thing.
I've always felt more kindred towards music acts. You know, if I have, you know, I don't lean towards listening to podcasts or comedians. You know, it's you know, I'd much rather listen to music. You know, I think you listen to a lot of music also.
Yes,
but,
I do.
But that always was, you know, the Who and the Kinks, you know, those were huge heroes of mine. And then when punk came around, that changed everything for me too. You know, it's funny. I've recently gone down a Queen rabbit hole, and I saw Queen when I was 13. And it was Day at the Races, so it's like Tie Your Mother Down and Somebody to Love, and it was one of the best rock shows I've ever saw in my life. But then when punk came along, I denied them completely. It's like, didn't you go to Queen? It's like, nah, I wouldn't go see Queen. Are you kidding me? Those arena rockers? No way.
Tomorrow morning, if I mention how much I like Queen to Tom Griswold, and he would go, you know, I say the same thing every time. I had no idea what, you know, I thought they were from England, so they're called Queen.
Oh, yeah. There was that thing, too.
I had no idea.
That thing was really funny. Because I'm with these 13-year-old guys who are confused about their own sexuality. And here's this guy in hot pants and a kimono.
And the big mustache.
And he's rocking. It's Liberace. You know, it's amazing, though. He was incredible. And because our world views weren't formed yet, we would be threatened by that, you know. Mm-hmm. That guy's gay. He's like, he's not gay. He rocks. You know, like, it's so funny too. Like,
but go listen to "We Will Rock You" and get back to me. Not the "We Are the Champions" part. That's fine too. But that Brian May's guitar and the God.
Yeah, and then I used the Queen Bowie song at the end of "World's Greatest Dad." You know,
and
I was terrified that I wasn't going to get the song because Robin's character plays a English teacher. That's what people think. Did you write the movie for Robin Williams? I go, if I was going to write a movie for Robin Williams, I think I'd stay away from poetry teacher. I think he covered that already pretty well.
He did that one pretty well.
But one of the students plagiarizes a song, and so I'd used that song, "Under Pressure." And it's funny, the new screenplay that I'm finishing right now, again, I went back and I think I'm going to end with another Queen song at the end. It seems to really it just hit home, you know, this idea I had actually on the way here.
Oh, really?
That's so strange, because on the way here too, I was thinking I was going to ask you how you score your score your own movies. You choose all the music and
But I'm always very open to everything. When there's certain songs that will be in the script, and it'll be very specific, and then, you know, I just fill the iPod with everything from my ex-wife would make suggestions. My daughter constantly makes suggestions. My, on God Bless America, the composer was this young guy who was a PA on the movie, and he was a terrible PA. And then he started helping in the editing. He was better at editing, and he wrote music and he said, listen to this, and I listened to it, and I tried it, you know, to picture, and none of it really worked. And then he just went off in the other room with a piano, and he came out, and then he ended up composing it. You know, and so the music comes from all over.
Right.
There's a song in World's Greatest Dad that's a big song, and the band they were PAs that had a band on Jackass, and The Deadly Syndrome. I mean, because my ex, she worked on Jackass 2. She's the person gluing pubic hairs on the guy's face. On Danger Aaron's face, yeah.
Oh,
it was really funny because I had ran into Billy Crystal and I was with Sarah, my ex, and he goes, yeah, I just saw that Jackass movie. I don't get it. You know, there's a scene where this guy's getting pubic hairs glued onto his face. And I go, yeah, that's my girl. And he looks, and he clearly his face goes ashy, and he goes, I didn't recognize you. But she truly is, you know, one of the funniest people I know. Or, you know, she just slays me. You know, she does costumes, and she was when you work on a movie or TV show and you're in the costume department, the echelon or everybody confuses that with the laundry service, you know.
Right.
Someone loses a button, you know, hey, I'm working, you know. Mm-hmm. Someone. So this producer on this TV show that she was working on came up, and she is a woman, and she clearly had just had a child, and she comes up and she goes, you know, how do I get, she was lactating. She goes, how do I get breast milk out of a blouse? And Sarah goes, time machine and abortion. And then takes a big beat and goes, boss.
Oh my gosh.
So she's, You know, and I'm very happy that my daughter and her are still very close and stuff. Yeah. So it's weird, you know, as you go older. It was funny. This will be name droppy, but I think it has to be because of the nature of the story. Eric Idle and his family, his wife Tanya and daughter Lily, they've been good family friends. My daughter's very close to that family. You know, Eric considers himself her godfather, but I'm like, well, I'm an atheist, so, you know, so we settled on dog father. You know, so.
easy. So, you're not anything. Hang on.
Yeah, so he's the dog father. Right. So, you know, this was just a hell of a year, you know, and, Robin passed away in a divorce and another breakup, and then I spend 12 hours a day editing a movie about, you know, listening to people talk about their childhood rapes. So it was a dark, dark year. And I sold a lot of tickets to that movie just then. I was talking to Eric, and it was a little bit after the holidays, and I'm like, I go, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. You know, I'm 52. I don't have a pot to piss in. I live in a single bedroom apartment. I have all these failed relationships behind me, and Eric goes, he goes, it's because you're romantic. He goes, you know, you could be making a fortune directing television, and you don't. You know, you make your own movies. You know, you just always believe in what if, and if a relationship doesn't work, you get out of it. It's because you're romantic. So I was talking to Billy Connolly recently.
Oh, yeah.
And I love Billy. And I told him that story. And I go, you know, because Eric says I'm a romantic. And Billy leans in and he goes, have you ever thought that it's because you're a failure?
But in that, goes, and then the Billy Connolly accent.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever thought you're a failure?
A wee failure?
A wee failure.
And brilliant. A brilliant wee failure.
A brilliant.
And he's like, did Eric
failure.
Tell you this? Was he in his fucking mansion when he told you this?
Let me ask you a question. Yeah. Was he in his fucking mansion when he told you?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy. Romantic. So, just tears, tears laughing. Billy is, I describe him as human pot. You know, there's no way not to be silly when you're around him. Yeah. He just is so infectious, you know.
Yeah, I think you put, you had a picture of you and Billy on Instagram, and I think that was the, you can't not smile around this guy.
He's just joy, you know, and I love that man. He's just so great. Yeah, I guess I've had a bumpy year, but I think here's what changed for me. Every New Year's, Toby Huss and myself and another friend.
I love Toby.
Right, he's the best. So Toby and you guys should. You know, he does this character with this filthy Christmas album. You guys should.
I should
send it to you.
You absolutely should. Yeah.
Rudy Cazzoni, he's Sinatra's illegitimate son, but then he finds out that he's actually Boxcar Willie's illegitimate son. His mother was having sex with Boxcar Willie
and Frank Sinatra, or maybe not.
Frank. Okay. So, and our friend John Wiener, and we every year we run into the ocean, and people say, "Oh, that's California. It's still cold. It's 50 right. degrees.
Sure,
doesn't feel great.
It's chilly. Yeah.
It's chilly. Sometimes it's colder than that." And we go and yell up to the universe what we want this year, you know. So it's like, you know, this is the year I get paid to be creative. This is the year I find my true love, you know, all these, you know. And I remember the first year I was like, I want snow tires. I should have aimed higher. But this year, I was looking at this year as a thing like, when is this stuff gonna stop? You know, it was just one after another, and it really was just insane. You know, like after my girlfriend she decides to move out, I'm not home so she can move out, and then she calls me and she goes, look, she goes, there's the police are here. There's a woman who says you stole her dog. And I go, you know, I like dogs, but I'm crazy about dogs. I would steal their cat. Ask her if she has a cat. And so She's in tears. She goes, he didn't take your dog. He's the finest man I know. It's just the worst. So it was just...
God.
And again, that was really random that the universe, that this nut job thinks I stole a dog. Because I did not steal a dog.
Right.
So it just... odd things, worst things, tragedies, all this stuff. And so when I went out in the ocean this year, instead of asking for, hey man, give me a break, I went out and I said, give me more pain. Bring it on. Like, who's to say that all this wasn't just tuning up for some bigger calamity? And once I thought in those terms, my whole attitude shifted. Like, I was no longer like, oh, this is all this terrible stuff's happening to me. It's like, yeah, all this stuff, terrible stuff happens to everybody. It's just your turn. This was, you know, and
why me? Why not me? Right?
Yeah. And the why not me? You know, it's when Nancy Kerrigan got hit, I think she yelled, why
she
me?
And
Tony was like, because this is a random violent culture and it was your turn, bitch. You know, that's what Tony said.
So the landscape isn't out there for unbelievably off the chart arena stand-up comedians who become wonderful movie directors. I mean, was that always there for you, or did you...
Well, thank you for saying that. I didn't know that this is what I wanted to do, but I'm so happy doing it. It's the thing that I love doing, you know, and I'm so happy. And I should have known as a kid that this is what I wanted to do, because even as a kid, I would look at a movie. I wouldn't even look at too much about what it was or anything. I would always go right to written and directed by.
So do you think you were more supposed to be a director than a comedian?
I think that that's...
I mean, if you had, you don't have to choose.
Well, you know, Tom Kenny has an interesting theory on this. He said that, you know, my earlier act, people didn't know who I was. I'd go on stage and I'd be this guy having a breakdown, or I'd clean and gut fish, or I'd read a Dear John letter and cry, you know. And you want to hear jokes, you know. My wife is so fat. How fat is she? I don't know. I told you I didn't have a wife, you know, so...
then sweating.
And Tommy said that I could no longer... freak out an audience because they knew that something weird was coming.
Right.
Okay.
So they were in on it. And he said that I turned to making movies because now I can still freak out an audience. But it's not, I don't approach the movies I make as, well, this is really going to mess with people's minds. These are just the subjects and things that I'm drawn to. These are the things that I find interesting. These are the things, you know, that's why I make these things. It's not... it isn't to freak people out, but it, you know, that was what he thought. Tommy, as a boy, loved Mel Blanc. I, as a kid, loved Mel Brooks. You know, and like I, even as a kid or later on as a teenager, I knew that Mel Brooks was Mel Brooks, and he was really funny on talk shows. But Mel Brooks also produced The Fly or produced Elephant Man. You know, I knew that. You know, or as a kid when I saw Producers, I was like, you know, this was. You know, it's a Hitler musical, and you know, I mean, it's so subversive and so, you know, so yeah, Mel Brooks was probably the guy that I, you know, was aping, you know, so, you know, I had that American dream or what people's perception is, you know, I had fame and I had money and it sounds like sour grapes, but I really wasn't happy and people. You know, I even think that a part of my lifestyle was dictated, my career choices was being a responsible parent in a weird way. Acting totally irresponsible on stage was being very responsible, bringing home the money to take care of my daughter and my stepson and this lifestyle that was overinflated and not needed. And you know, I can take responsibility for some of that. And then I also lived with people that had no problem spending crazy amounts of money. But I quit everything. I don't know how many years ago, it's probably mid-40s, and just would only do things that I wanted to. It was right after my daughter graduated from college and I didn't have to make any more money basically. And I just quit and I just started doing my own thing and that changed everything. I mean, the real story is I was directing Kimmel and Sarah had read the script that I had written a year ago, and it was called Stay at the time. It became Sleeping Dogs Lie, and she was like, this is a really good script. We should make it. I go, I don't have any money. She goes, well, we'll just start filming it, and people will help and kick in. So we got a crew from Craigslist. We shot it for $20,000, and then that movie went on to Sundance, you know? So that was what changed everything. And then after that point, I just, you know, now I still work for other people, but it's people I respect or people who are my friends. And I direct people's comedy shows or their stand-up specials. And then make about a movie a year, maybe a little less. I'm trying to amp that up. You know, someone recently in an interview, they said, well, you know, you did a found footage horror picture, and now you did a documentary, and then you did, you know, a dark rom-com, and you do, you know, which filmmakers are you in your head competing with? And I said, I'm competing with the Grim fucking Reaper. I'm not really looking over at what other guys who make movies do or women that make movies do. I'm just trying to, I found out what I love doing, and I'm just trying to get as many of them in before I slip off this mortal coil.
So you obviously direct them for yourself, and you like the guys on you mentioned Mel Blanc. I mean, the Warner Brothers guys, famously, I think they said that we do these cartoons, they make us laugh, and
I'm sure, and
you go back and watch them, and they're amazing.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, the new movie is being very well received, and a little part of me is like. Going, you're not gonna like the next one. You know what I mean? Because the same brain that said, hey, I wanna make a scary Bigfoot movie is the same brain that said, I wanna make a documentary about this guy who I find fascinating and think he's a hero, you know. So you know, the one I think I'll be doing next is more similar to like Sleeping Dogs Lie or World's Greatest Dad. It's another it's in along those lines, you know. But that's, I haven't done that kind of movie in a while, so I want to go back and make another one.
So
what I remember when we saw
World's Greatest Dad.
World's Greatest Dad, and then God Bless America, and I said, I think you should watch this first and then let me know if I can watch it. And he was like, no, you're out.
You can't. Really? Yeah, God Bless America?
Oh, God Bless America? Like, no.
Goes, no.
Well, she's the same one, though. Or we were trying to watch.
I'm the same one?
You're the same.
Uh-huh.
You're not the same one that was going through all the money.
Right.
You're the same one.
Well, thank you.
No, you were telling stories. You were saying, like, this overinflated lifestyle that was not needed, and people at my house were going through money that... I've had that happen to me. But my point is...
when we watched...
the one with Steve Buscemi on HBO, where he's the
Natural
gangster.
Natural Born Killers?
Natural... Well, that's true, too.
Yeah.
I didn't know her very well, and it was one of these...
Broadway Empire?
Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire. She, at the time, we lived together, and she'd stand in the kitchen, what's happening now?
Yeah, I'm bad at that.
And I go, don't come in. They've all got guns. Don't come in. But
well, baby does get shot with a shotgun, but it's
true.
Tastefully done. Yeah. And that baby was an asshole. But
yeah, and you don't act. You made a cut. You don't.
It's all implied.
Oh, that's right.
There was so much gore. We left that soundstage with baby guts on the ceiling.
Oh my gosh!
I was amazed that no one has approached after his performance after Joel Murray in God Bless America. I keep waiting to hear that he's going to be in this unbelievable movie because he's such a great dramatic actor.
I love him. Amazing actor. But you know, and this isn't self-deprecating. It's the reality. It's like I'm thrilled that people find my movies and that there are people who like them. But in the actual reality of them, most people don't know I make movies, and most people, I know that sounds, because you're fans, you know, you do watch my movies, but most people don't, you know. And when you said Steve Buscemi the other night, I met him. I had never met him before, and we shared a table, and he was nothing but sweet. And you know, I think it's hard sitting there talking about Police Academy all day. This guy just getting hammered, and everybody's just coming up, and they're all talking to him about Adam Sandler movies. And I'm like, he's Donnie.
I'd gone Big Lebowski.
Yeah, I know.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie.
Yeah, shut the fuck up. Yeah,
you have no frame of reference, Donnie.
They're doing the lipstick in the Adam Sandler movie where he's crazy.
Oh, and he crosses the name off.
But I'm just like, I'm you're burying the lead. It's Donnie, you know. So,
have you ever seen Buscemi's movie? It's called Living in Oblivion.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. But then he directed a movie called Trey's Lounge or Trees Lounge. It's it was around the
time. Title's familiar.
It was around the time of Shakespeare. But so I was talking to him, and he was nothing but delightful and everything you would want Steve Buscemi to be. But as we were talking, it was clear to me that he had no idea that I made movies. And it didn't hurt my feelings, but it also just kind of put it in perspective. Well, that's 100% why, like, when I'm making a movie and I try to get an actor, there's resistance, you know?
Hmm.
You know, you would think Steve Buscemi, who's involved in the indie world, might have seen World's Greatest Dad or God Bless America or you know, one
or
of these.
Willow Creek or one. Or,
yeah, or you know.
Or Sleeping Dog's Lot.
Or Windy City Heat or Windy Shakes City. The Clown. He did mention Shakes, but, you know, that was 1992. But, like I said, I'm just giving a perspective, and I run into that. It's funny that I run into that in show business so much, you know?
Right.
You would think it'd be the other way around, the general public, but in show business, I run into it because, sadly, you know, if you're not making box office films, it gets very frustrating with me when I'm not frustrating, but it's when you know, I can't promise anyone that I'm going to change the career. I can't promise that it's going to make a lot of money. I can't promise you anything.
So are those questions that you're asked when you ask someone to be in your movie?
No, but I'm thinking if you're someone that is an actor, but I can, odds are, it's going to be a festival film.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't you interested in that as an actor?
Right.
You know, that's all. You know, I mean, if it didn't, it'd be the first one out of seven that didn't make festivals. You know what I mean? So. You know, that's slightly frustrating, but it just means the byproduct is I work with my friends, which I love. You know, I Joel, I've known from One Crazy Summer. So,
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
And he was so young.
And I had back surgery, and he dropped off over a bunch of Mad Men. And I was just high on Dilaudid recovering from major back surgery. And Sarah was like, you should have Joel play Frank. Exactly.
Perfect. Yeah.
And so I sent him the script, but because I was high, I didn't say, oh, I want you to play the lead. I said, hey, read the script. And he goes, okay. And he goes, it's the boss? Like, he was trying to figure out what role. He goes, is the boss? I go, no, man, I want you to be Frank. And he goes, the guy? So then it was really funny because he calls Bill Murray's his brother, so he calls him up, and he just leaves him a message saying, hey, I'm about to star in my first lead. Is there any pointers? And so Bill calls him back 3 weeks later and says, well, you know, it's about pacing yourself. He's like, look, this is a Bobcat Goldthwait film. We wrapped.
We're done. Thanks.
We're done.
Thanks, though, Bill.
That was 19 days, so we're done.
Yeah.
Wow.
I loved you. I can't not gush a little bit. That your whole performance in Scrooged, I can't tell you. I mean, I know it's Bill Murray's line, but you're the one who causes him to say, well, it's a little late to get this type of feedback.
And then you
so earnestly go, oh, thanks a lot. You know,
but that kind of stuff, though, that bit in that is definitely Bill and I riffing back and forth.
Right.
You know, that was the script was great, but you know, we would riff. And Bill truly is the funniest person I've ever been around. You know, it's just crazy the amount of stuff he would just pitch and then not put in the movie. It was very strange. And I think in hindsight, I think, oh, this is because Bill, and much like Robin, you know, see themselves as actors first, you know.
I was just going to say that about you. I think you've always seen yourself as a director first. Maybe.
Yeah, or maybe a storyteller. I don't know if I knew, but certainly a storyteller. Like, if I'm not the life of the party, but if I am, when it does turn to me, I'm sitting there telling stories. And you know, my act is mutated into me telling stories. And you know, I, 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 uh, you know, it's there's something about when you make a movie and if it all clicks and works for people, it's insane. You know, it gives me that rush when I first started, like, can I go on stage and be funny for 5 minutes, you know, and now to make an audience, you know, cry or yelp or you know, the repercussions of this movie was nothing I had anticipated, because I think I'm just a part of the story of telling it, and Barry's story is another thing. And then I think it's hit some sort of something subconscious with people, because after the screenings at the film festivals, you know, there'll be a number of adult male survivors that come up, you know, and they're all puffy eyed and mm-hmm. they've been crying and they tell us their stories. And it's
well, when you sent me the movie and I emailed you back and I said I knew that Barry Crimmins had been a stand up and a comedian, but I wasn't familiar with his material. I wasn't familiar, obviously, with what happened to him when he was 4 years old. Yeah. I don't know. Well, and you've told me that there's a scene where he has to revisit.
He goes back into the basement where he was raped as a kid, you know, and it becomes an important part of the movie, because I'm ruining it for people. So spoiler, you can turn it off for a couple of minutes, but or fast forward. But without that, you know, Barry says you go through a problem, not around it. And he was trying mm-hmm. to demystify the space, and he didn't want it to have power anymore. But we had a huge fight because I didn't want him to go into the basement. You know, I'd seen him already reacting, and he was starting to go into shock. He starts doing this weird thing with his throat. He's clearing it, and he says, "Well, I'm going in there. You know, we're not making a shrine to demons. I'm going in there. You can film it or not." So he goes in there, and he's so articulate, and it shows you as a viewer that Barry's more than okay. And it's key in the movie, but afterwards he said, I was totally in shock, and I have no idea what I said in the basement. Is any of that usable? And I said, oh, it doesn't matter. I'm playing Yakety Sax the whole time you're dying.
That's right.
So, I mean, and it's interesting, the kind of gallows humor while we were making this movie, because it's maybe it's not gallows humor. I mean, that's the nature of the movie. There's a lot of laughs in the movie, mm-hmm. and it ends up being very hopeful at the end.
Oh,
and
it's
a powerful movie, and it's not just that. There's all these other elements in it too. But it's weird to you know, if I'm making a narrative, these aren't real people. But when you're making a documentary, these are real mm-hmm. people. So you're always balancing a fine line of being respectful to the people that's your subjects and people that are, you know, disclosing stuff. And it's a tightrope I walked while editing the movie.
How did this come up? How did this subject matter? How did this?
Yeah, I was going to ask how you talked. Was there a talking into process for Barry?
No,
or?
No. I, you know, I always knew Barry's story and his battle with AOL and that he went to the Senate floor and, mm-hmm. all, you know, all of these things. I was going to make a narrative. I was going to write a screenplay, and I actually took a swipe at it, and Barry did too. And because I didn't want Barry to relive this stuff.
Right.
So then when, you know, I heard him on WTF, you know, I heard him on Maron's podcast, and I could hear that he was comfortable in talking about this stuff in a way where I could see that he had gone through it. But it really was because of Robin. You know, I was telling him about how difficult it is to get this made as a narrative, and he suggested I make it as a documentary, and he gave me the initial money to start the movie. Some people think he financed the movie, but he didn't. He just gave but he did give me the initial money. And that was just last February. And then it got into Sundance in October. So it was a crazy turnaround for a documentary. I had no idea.
Wow. Yeah.
It was crazy because I went to dinner at Sundance with the other documentary filmmakers, and they're like...
I'm guessing years, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long have you been working? Oh, 7 years. The other guy's 3 years. They go, when, I go, I started in February. And they didn't look at me like, yeah, good job. They're right. Like, ooh, ooh, well, I hope.
And it's done?
They okay. Go, yeah, yeah, great. Exactly. Yeah. So they're all, all right, well, good luck with that.
It's, I mean, it's like all your movies. It's beautifully shot and... Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that Barry also, for lack of a better, I mean, he didn't give you your first break, but I mean, he hired you a lot early on,
oh,
right?
Yeah, definitely give me, I would say that, because Tom Kenny and I saw an ad in the local paper looking for comedians, and so we were high schoolers, and he thought we were men, because we called him up, and then we showed up, and he goes, oh, the fucking kiddie core, that's what he said.
And then did he say his name wasn't Barry? What did he call himself?
Well, yeah. He didn't say I'm Bearcat. People did call him Bearcat. And then Tom Kenny and I, being sarcastic little pricks, were like, oh, that's funny, I'm Tom Kenny. Oh, I'm Bobcat. And you know.
And fast forward to the only right. one that stuck.
Yeah, I'm Bobcat, and they're Tom and Barry, so... That was a great joke. Hearty fucking har har. But you know, Barry's, I think he's happy with the movie.
If he, as happy as he gets. Because he lives alone somewhere up in the north. I want to say Alaska, but that's not right.
But it's you have to
somewhere
go down,
cold.
You have to go down two dirt roads to get to the properties.
That, and but, he's chopping wood, and he's like, I don't have any problems. Wham! I'm fine. Yeah, wham!
Well, fuck this. So I would say Barry is much like myself, fulfilled. You know,
mm-hmm.
And there's like during the Q&As, people will go, you know, they'll act as if like, you know, are you upset that you never were famous, or are you upset that, you know, you didn't make a fortune? Were you upset, you know, because of the people that he mentored or was peers with, you know, not just me and Kevin Meaney and Stephen Wright, but, you know, folks like David Cross and, you know, all these people. And, you know, Barry the other day just ripped into someone in the audience. He was just like, he goes, I've never had a job, you know, I've had a great life,
right.
You know, and I was like, yeah, you know, cause he's done it all on his own terms, you know, and
making
so,
work seem like play, right? That's the, goal.
Well, or at least, you know, not compromising who you are, which is more important to Barry than anything, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think you'll do another documentary?
No.
No.
No, I thought that. I actually did say that. I was like, man, I'm never going to make another documentary. And then recently one
Well, you yourself
was presented
said, though,
to me.
I don't think you work with your friends. You do the movies you want to do, the movies you write for the most. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the movies. I don't think you would do it. There's no way you would do a documentary if you weren't involved somehow in the story, right?
Yeah, three things. You know, one, I'd have to have a personal connection. Two, there'd have to be something other than what you thought the subject was going to be going in. That would have to be key to me. And three, at the end of the day, it would have to be somewhat life reaffirming, which sounds really silly coming from me because people think of me as dark. But, you know, at the end of the day, that is in most of the movies. And now I know after spending time doing a doc that I couldn't make a doc at the end where the message is that it's so bleak. I mean, there's docs mm-hmm. out right now that I've watched that are about where we're heading as a culture. And they are very... They're not pessimistic. They're realistic, and it looks really grim, you know. And mm-hmm. I have a number of friends who are wealthy enough to go off the grid, you know. Mm-hmm. And I refuse to. I think creating is just, you got to keep making stuff, because that's the, you know, that's the big middle finger to death. You know, you just got to keep making stuff. I want to go out swinging. I'm not going to go out and go off the grid.
We didn't get to how we kind of hit it off over our mutual love for Lifetime movies.
Lifetime movies, yes.
We didn't talk about Betty Broderick.
That's real?
Oh, sure. Oh,
no, the Lifetime movies?
I think it was Mother May I Sleep with Danger.
Mother May I Sleep with Danger and...
Marky Post Chasing the Dragon.
Marky Post.
Portrayal of a heroin-addicted mom.
Oh, and Betty Broderick, her Betty Final
Broderick,
Fury.
Yeah.
Her Final Fury.
Well, that one and two.
One and two. Final Fury.
Final Fury.
Yeah. And Meredith Baxter Burney with Betty Broderick, her greatest role.
Yeah.
And Men Don't Tell with Peter Strauss and Judith Light, where he's abused. He's physically abused by the wife. We talked about that.
Yeah, I watched a lot of Lifetime movies.
I had no idea.
Yeah. In fact, that's...
I remember he was sitting right there, and he says that, and I go, you don't watch. Well, what about Mother May I Sleep with Danger? And yeah, great movie. And then Tom's sitting, what the hell?
What are they talking about? Because of my addictive personality, when I had back surgery, I'd given Sarah the pain medicine said, I don't trust myself with this.
Yep.
Because I'm just going to start playing games and math and it's time. And I go, you dole these out as prescribed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she came home one day, and I was watching Lifetime, and I'm just sobbing and sobbing. And she goes, you don't get any more Dilaudid.
Well, thank you, Bobcat, for being on our podcast.
Oh, well, thank you. That flew by. I hope I wasn't too much of a blowhard.
What?
No, not at all.
What? We didn't even tell the blow story. Tell the blow story real quick.
Which one?
The one where you're testing that scene with Johnny
Depp. With Johnny Depp.
And Paul Rubens.
And I did say this. I said, is anybody in the scene not on probation? But the funny thing is I tell that story on stage, and Johnny Depp, you know, he's like, yeah, I set the Tonight Show on fire. And he's like, I go, you smashed up that hotel room. And he's funny. He goes, in my defense, the hotel room made the first move.
That's a great Johnny Depp.
But the funny thing was the whole conversation, Paul Rubens just kind of pretended we weren't talking.
Yeah, I didn't say anything.
It was just like...
You guys know.
I was beating off.
He didn't say... No, but he was really like... I mean, when I tell the story, I say, Johnny Depp, and I look over at him and go, yeah, anyhow. But that's not what happened. What really happened was we're having this conversation, and Paul's really like, you know, picking... lint off of his jacket and stuff. Yeah.
He's a good actor, too.
Paul is, yeah.
Paul's a great actor.
They're doing another Pee-wee movie.
I know, I saw that.
Yeah.
All right, I'll let you guys wrap this up. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bobcat, very much. Thank you, Jess. Okay, that's the Off the Air podcast. Bobcat, what's your website? What do you want to tell people?
Hey, you get in touch. I'm on Instagram.
Instagram.
And Twitter. But Instagram's the way. That's my jam.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Tell everybody about the Off the Air podcast. I'm all in the gurgle in the body still. This is only some kind of bad dream. Don't worry, baby, I'll figure out something. Give him a slip, they won't be expecting the singer. Slip him a Mickey and give him a finger. I had him cooking for a ringer, but I had no idea the DEA was using the singer. But it's all right, cause I love you, baby. It's all right, cause I love you, girl. It's all right, cause I love you, baby. You ready? You ready? Let's roll. It's alright, cause I love you, baby. It's alright, cause I love you, girl. It's alright, cause I love you, baby. You ready? I'm ready. Let's roll.